Next speaker is Dr. Serap, opioid sparing practices in surgery. He will be discussing post-operative pain management for the hospitalized patient. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks for coming early in the morning on the last day. It was an honor to be on this highly academic panel coming from rural America, but clearly rural Americans have been decimated by the opioid epidemic. The other problem is surgeons in rural America don't have pain teams. They don't have a cadre of anesthesiologists that can do all these kind of fancy things for us, and so it rests on our shoulders to a great degree. I have nothing to disclose other than I work in rural America. So the multimodal approach is what we've talked about several times today, and I'm just going to list those and kind of briefly go through them. Certainly, I'm not an anesthesiologist. We have one on the panel to ask questions for, but I want to mention that the blocks that they give for intraoperative pain bridge over, and they're very helpful for postoperative pain as well. So systemic opioids, neuraxial blocks, peripheral blocks, wound infiltration, many of us have been using that for a long time, intravenous lidocaine in the NSAIDs, acetaminophen, gabapentinoids, glucocorticoids, adrenergic receptors, and these NMDA classification of drugs that are kind of a weird group, and tramadol. If you pull out nothing else from this talk, this reference at the bottom of the page from WIC in last year's JAMA Surgery is a wonderful, very highly classified list of things that you can use and the risks of benefits, and much of my material comes from that, as well as other recent literature. There's tons of literature just in the last 18 months, if you look at that. I've added three things, cyclobenzaprine, topical ice, and alternative medicine techniques as well. So again, I'm going to just touch on the blocks because they do bridge over to the postoperative period as well. And the advantages to all these blocks and everything that I'm going to talk about in terms of non-opioid alternatives is that you use less opioids and you have less of the side effects that you usually get from using opioids, greater return of GI function, those kinds of things. So epidurals have significant advantages. Most of these techniques also, that one of the disadvantages is basically technical failure. If you're an anesthetist or an anesthesiologist doesn't quite get the catheter in the right place, or if it's there can be several technical failures as well. All these things that give neuraxial blocks have a higher tendency of urinary retention, which is one of the CME questions if you're looking for CME. Those are the things that you have to worry about a little bit. And then you can give spinal or intrathecal kinds of blocks as well. And these blocks can use opioids, but they can use local anesthetics as well. And again, less nausea and vomiting if you give these things non-systemically. But you can have, if you give the blocks with opioids, you can still get the itching. And you can get respiratory depression when they get absorbed systemically as well. There's all kinds of blocks, and everybody is familiar with the TAP block, much less pain, opioid sparing. I think there's a little discontinuity in the literature about whether we can use the long-acting bupivacaine or just the regular in terms of how we do this. Disadvantages, again, technical failure. It only lasts as long as the local anesthetic that you're using. You can get toxicity from that. You can have perforation of the peritoneum and bowel injury if you have someone doing this that's not quite good with the ultrasound. You can have a pneumothorax if you go higher up with these paravertebrals or sometimes a thoracic type of block. I would tell you as a surgeon, if your anesthesia folks are not familiar with this, you can do these yourself. If you're facile with ultrasound, just take a course. But the other thing that you can do is if you're doing a laparoscopic case, you can put the needle in all the way, bring it back, and the plane that you want this in is just above the peritoneum. You can do this open when you're doing an open laparotomy. You can do it from the inside as well. So you don't have to rely on your anesthesia folks, but it's great to have them on part of the team. Just a couple of things from the recent literature that I'll throw out there is a TAP block with a liposomal bupivacaine. That's the long-acting, in a standard protocol, had half the rate of urinary retention, as did an epidural. So the epidurals do have a tendency to do that. Paravertebral block, same kind of thing. The advantages are less pain, less opioids. Disadvantages if you can have a technical failure, you can have some hypotension from this, and you can have a puncture of the pleura. And again, wound infiltration, we've been doing it forever. There's really no downside to this. It's fast, it's simple, it's minimal risk. The disadvantage is that when your local anesthetic goes away, then the pain relief goes away. That's been the benefit, really maybe the only benefit of the liposomal bupivacaine with anorectal cases or anal cases. It's been very effective. And it's not really a block. It's a local that you have to put several punctures around the anus to use this effectively because it doesn't disperse like the other anesthetics. Just another pull out from the literature, the AGS in 2018, they compared continuous epidural analgesia versus continuous infusion of preperitoneal wound catheters. That was kind of a hot thing recently as well. And the continuous infusion did not reduce morphine consumption. It didn't enhance the recovery. I think there's all kinds of things coming out. IV lidocaine has already been discussed. It causes less pain. GI function, length of stay is down. The disadvantage is it's unclear post-op efficacy in terms of studying it significantly and teasing it out from the other things you're using. I think this multimodality thing, everybody is throwing everything at patients with these ERAS protocols. We're not sure what effect each medication and each modality has on that. Most of institutions, particularly where I live, they're going to freak out with an IV lidocaine drip on the floor. So you have to kind of work those out. You certainly can't use systemic lidocaine or other similar medicines if you're using the liposomal bupivacaine because it neutralizes it. You don't get that effect. Lidocaine patches are a new thing coming down. We use them for trigger spots and things like that. But some people kind of seem like this may be a pretty good thing in the future, but we're not sure about the optimum dosing that are used. NSAIDs, I think everybody's using that. It's pretty significant how much decreased opioids you use when you use these NSAIDs. They cause platelet dysfunction. You can have GI tract irritation, and there's the worry that you're going to cause GI bleeding, renal dysfunction, and then this whole business about anastomotic leakage. The things that are on the that we're using in all these protocols, if you look across the countries, ibuprofen, naproxen, Celebrex, and meloxicam. It's incredible that 600 milligrams of ibuprofen is as good as 15 milligrams of oxycodone. That struck me as just amazing when I saw that. And they work through a cyclooxygenase and prostaglandin synthesis kind of pathway. You can use them oral and IV, so that's great. But you have to have them. They should be given on a scheduled routine, so every 6 hours or every 8 hours to get the maximum benefit from these NSAIDs. And one study showed that there was no increased bleeding from these for using Ketorolac. A huge study of 23 childs, 1,500 patients showed that if you have normal renal function before the surgery, the use of NSAIDs is going to cause an insignificant bump, but clinically insignificant. So they're very safe to use if your pre-op renal function is fine. This is the Washington paper from the Washington Scope outcomes assessment, and with Celebrex and anastomotic leakage, their leak rate was 12.3% with the anti-inflammatories versus 8.3%. And it's really heartwarming to me to see that this clinical congress has had several more papers that have come through. And I don't think the question is quite answered yet. Recent experience also affects surgeons more than anything. And for the first time that I could remember, I had an anastomotic leak since I've been using Celebrex on my colon cancer patients. So I'm very frustrated by that, and I'm very unclear whether I'm going to use anti-inflammatory. So just like all surgeons, the most recent experience affects your next several cases. Acetaminophen, we've been using it for a very long time, less pain, opioid sparing. It has toxic liver effects if you use it too much. It, again, should be on a scheduled basis. We use a dose, 1,000, every 6 hours after we do a big case, an open laparotomy or a lap ventral hernia, something like that, and use them with the NSAIDs together. They do better. Actually, the maximum dose in some of the protocols have been decreased to 3 grams a day from 4 to prevent the liver problems. And there's this controversy about whether you should give it IV or PO. It's a buck oral and $34 for an IV dose. If they can take oral, that's great. My anesthesia folks seem to think that you get better penetration and blood levels IV, and so we're still doing that. And then the gabapentinoids have exploded on the market. We always used to use it for neuropathy, But now this is part of most of these. You have less pain, opioid sparing. The disadvantage is it causes dizziness, and so you have to worry about it with elderly patients. Again, maybe a CME question if you're looking for CME, but this is one of the modalities that if you're over 70 or 75, a little frail, it may be reasonable to leave that off the list. It's some studies have said that it works really well. A single dose kicks in that night of surgery, and it decreases postoperative pain, decreased opioid consumption, and it's part of most of these protocols. I will tell you that if you looked at the ACS Digital News that came out yesterday, it showed that in most of the year, a significant number of opioid overdoses and deaths, they also had Neurontin in their system. So unfortunately, it has become part of this whole culture of abuse. Some people think that it potentiates the opioids that people are taking illegally. So now we have to worry about something we're replacing the opioids with causing problems himself. So it helps. And I think it's worthwhile. Glucocorticoids just need to be mentioned that they have less pain, reduced length of recovery room stay. We have our folks give that occasionally, but you have to worry about high glucose levels. And then there's this whole kind of a funky, weird group of drugs called the NMDAs. It includes ketamine, magnesium, which has already been mentioned this morning, dextromethorphan, which I think it comes in cough syrup, and methadone. Ketamine's used intra-op quite a bit, but people are using it, as Leah's mentioned, for sub-anesthetic doses post-operatively as an infusion, and it decreases the use of PCAs, and it decreases nausea and vomiting. She's also using magnesium, and I'd love to try that as well, but there's several studies out there, and dextromethorphan, just something new on the horizon that some have already adopted, and there's some studies going on. And then tramadol is this other medicine that is, it's partly affects the opioid receptors and partly non-opioid receptors. And it's a really great substitute for Norco or Percocet after surgery. And we're using that pretty significantly. It gets metabolized to an active metabolite. And it gets rid of through the renal and hepatic route. It does give you analgesia, less chance for addiction, less respiratory effects, less GI effects, but it also increases the risk for seizures. So you need to kind of rule out a seizure preponderance in your patients. And you can get this serotonin syndrome in patients that are on SSRIs. Just want to touch on one thing. We've all had these patients that either a laparotomy or a big lap hernia. And it's not so much pain, but they're writhing in bed from spasms. It just seems like their rectus is seized up, and they're really screaming, and it seems like the opioids don't help. So a lot of times we use muscle relaxers. And so Flexeril's been kind of a common thing. It's a tricyclic antidepressant that failed basically as an antidepressant, and it was redeveloped, remarketed as a muscle relaxant. It's very similar to amitriptyline, but there is a sudden cardiac death risk, anticholinergic side effects, and some sedation. So I would propose to you that if you have these patients, if you want to use that for a medicine when you have this occasional spasm patient, you can use Robaxin or Metoxolone, which is Skelexin. They have a higher safety profile, less sedation. And then why don't you throw in ice? I mean, it's cheap, it's easy. The orthopods are way ahead of us on this. If everybody has had a knee done, you see that part of your payment is that they send this big cooler and a pump, and it cools the ice water and puts it around the joint. And that's part of the postoperative pain, and it works. And so we put ice on every one of these abdominal wounds. You know, what can it hurt? High safety profile. And there are some small studies that do show that it decreases opioids at several time points. So in summary, I just pulled a couple of ERAS protocols from, we have residents come from the Dayton program, and one of them offered one of their protocols for me. It is multimodality all over the place. This is from Wright State and Dayton. This is from an article in JAX 2017. Again, components of all those things that I have talked about previously. This is from the MD Anderson Liver Service, which these are big, open, transverse incision, subcostal. It's a lot of pain, and this is their protocol. All of these obviously use narcotics or opioids as a backup plan when they fail. I just wanted to tell you about our experience in a small rural community is that we started doing this about 2 years ago. We do have anesthetists, which is the standard of care in most rural communities, but they have really jumped on board with this. They're doing blocks. They've gone off and get trained up. But we looked at opioids the first 6 months of 2017 and the first 6 months of 2018. You see there, with our protocols and our attention to trying to decrease opioids, across the board, we're about 50% in the hospital and in the PACU and in the surgical services as well. In just 1 year's time, this stuff really works. And I think the talking about this with expectations with patients is pretty good. So the local factors that we kind of feel like physician education about the opioid crisis, Ohio is the top three in opioid deaths in the country. We've been decimated by that. Physician education about the alternatives, anesthesia, interest, institution of protocols, and then there was this nationwide shortage. Anybody feel that in their hospitals? Of IV opioids. And so we just didn't have them, and it was a great opportunity to improve because of a drawback. So I also want to send a congratulations to Tara and Kathleen. Have done a wonderful job with the college work group on opioids, and I think it's worked out great. Thank you very much.
Wow, there was so much wonderful information in that talk. I think I have to watch that a couple more times to make sure I got everything. I think one thing I'd like to pull out of that is that you mentioned having a plan preoperatively, preemptively treating them at their pain, and then scheduling like the Tylenol and Toradol and other medications. And I got to say, that was one of the hardest changes for us to make, because the nurses would say, oh, well, they're on this scheduled Toradol, but they don't have pain. Because it was such a culture of asking, well, do you have any pain? But really getting to that point where they just every few hours got something, got Tylenol, got Toradol, really fundamentally changed. So I thought those were great points that I just wanted to make sure I pulled out. Any questions for Dr. Serup? Do you mind just using the mic since we're... Or holler out and I'll repeat.
I know my voice is a little weak, but hopefully it carries. You mentioned a pre-op dose. What is the dose pre-op?
So the question is, what is the preoperative dose of gabapentin?
And so what we're using is somewhere between 100 and 200 milligrams, or if you use Lyrica, it's 75 milligrams preoperatively. And technically, you know, people that are really doing this really well are giving a patient a prescription to take it the day before. But the very least, we give it the morning of surgery, so it kicks in for that peak pain 12 hours after their surgery. So 100 or 200 of Neurontin or 75 of Lyrica preoperatively that morning works pretty good. Yeah, and you know, they're in those protocols that I put up there. It's all over the place. Some people are given 400 milligrams of Neurontin, and I'm a little scared at that. My pharmacist didn't like it either, so we've had to kind of bargain back and forth about what our protocol is going to have on it. But yeah, 100 to 200 in Rotten is what we're using that morning.
So there are lots of protocols. There's some, you saw a couple websites that are on the slides. I'd encourage those who are looking just for protocols to go to some of them and download them. And as has been mentioned, having these procedure specific really does help a lot. We use, I use Neurontin when I do component separations for big abdominal wall cases. It helps a lot. They get a prescription, they get the night before and then the morning of. But all cases get Tylenol and ibuprofen 2 hours before the case. So everybody has little different sort of takes on what they take and what they give. The Michigan Open website is one of many. Our group also has some stuff published. You can just, this is what we do for inguinal hernia, and just take it and download it. Yep. Right. So two important points I just want to repeat on the mic so everyone can hear. The side effect that you worry about with Neurontin can be sedation. So at 400 milligrams, it'll cause sedation. So the point was, if you're just giving it preoperatively, that's probably, meaning like right before surgery, it's probably not a problem. And that in the prisoner system, they've seen abuse from gabapentin, so it's no longer on the formulary, so they have taken it off. So those are a couple excellent points. I don't give it to patients who are 70 or older. That's my cutoff of preoperatively as well because of the sedation. And I also want to point out, since we're all jumping to try and institute other medications that can supplement for opioids, but we have to constantly ask what are the other side effects of those. And I wanted to bring up the tramadol one because there has been this sort of like rush on the pharmacies for tramadol at this point, and everybody seems to be using it. And a few key points. It still is, it's kind of a dirty drug. It blocks a lot of things. It blocks, acts in a lot of ways, but it is an opioid. It does act at the opioid receptor. It is an opioid analgesic. So if patients are on tramadol chronically, don't just say, oh, that's a minor drug. Stop that. We want you to stop all. We see a lot of tramadol withdrawal now from people who are trying to do the right thing, quote unquote, and decrease people. All opioids need to be tapered down. They should be done in conjunction with someone who knows how to help you if you don't know how to do it. So just be careful of that. And the serotonin syndrome is that's real. So if they're on SSRIs, be careful of that. So as you start to explore what other things, I think most people are very comfortable using Tylenol and ibuprofen because they're used to those medications. But if you're not used to tramadol, gabapentin, make sure you do the due diligence and look into the common side effects and everything. So with that, thank you for that conversation.